The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Thumping on the chords here. I want to tell you about what may happen here in Philadelphia. And I tell you this not just to illustrate one application of homogeneity, but I want you to pray about it. We have a student here, a D-Men student, by the name of Anis Siha Zaka. Some of you know him. Anis is an Egyptian, and he is he's had a lot of experience in the Middle East. He was pastoring for about 10 years in Syria, Arabic-speaking congregation. And he is a PCA missionary to Muslims here in Philadelphia area. Now, Anis has developed a very unique approach, and it's contextualized. He is addressing the Ahmadiyyan Muslims from Pakistan. And the Ahmadiyyan Muslims are a little different than classic Islam. They have some aberrations in their theology, so to speak. They believe, for example, that Jesus, of course, as all Muslims, they believe that Jesus was not crucified. Somebody else died on the cross. Jesus escaped. But they have the additional teaching that he went to Pakistan and that he was buried in Pakistan. They have his grave in Pakistan. Now, that is not classic Islam. So they are considered a bit of a sect within Islam. But there are 40 to 50,000 of these Pakistani Muslims here in the United States. And Anis is directing his message to that group, which seems to be more receptive. And there have been three encounters on Sunday afternoons between Christians and the Sheikh with a group of his followers from the Ahmadi Muslims. The first one, Dr. Ed Clowney spoke to. The second one I spoke to. I believe Harvey Kahn spoke. Maybe this is they've had four. And the last one, Dave Clowney addressed. And then you have your counterpart, a Sheikh. He talks to us Christians. And it's openly missionary from both sides, because they are quite a missionary group. I mean, from the Islamic side, they are trying to convince Christians. However, the strange thing is, they seem to be the ones that are opening up. They're being shaken by this. On the surface, when we meet, you don't see it. But the conversations afterwards, the telephone calls that Anis receives indicate something's happening. On the 29th of January, he and a couple of men went to see the Sheikh in Washington, D.C. And the Sheikh is quite something to behold. And they challenged him to bring his entire community into Christianity. Now, this is where the contextualization particularly enters, because they are not likely to come in great number if they have to come one by one. But if the Sheikh says, the time has come, we have made some mistakes, Jesus is the Messiah, and the gospel is true, he probably would take a large percentage of the whole movement with him. Well, on the 29th of January, they not only proposed to him that he come with his whole group, but they offered him a presbytery. I love this. I don't know if Anis checked this out with some of the authorities, but anyway, they said, we will let you come as a group, and you can have your own congregations. And we'll let you be a presbytery. And a few other things. How about, I don't know what he promised, but maybe like, you know, Sunday on Saturday or something like that. But now, just imagine for a moment. We're talking about homogeneity and contextualization. What if they came and said, we will have our services on Friday night and Saturday. We will pray kneeling on prayer rugs, and toward the east, Jerusalem, of course. We want to call our bishop by a Muslim name or Arabic name. What if they came with kind of a list of, and we want to keep our dietary laws? No kimchi. And what if they came with that? Well, yeah, maybe you kind of know what I think, but how do you think the PCA would feel about a proposal like that? For joy, do you think? Well, you know, that's not unlike some of the questions that McGavern met up with in India. And he saw missionaries divided on questions like that when entire caste groups wanted to come into the church. You got to remember, McGavern was born and raised in India. And after getting his education in North America, he went back to India for 30 years. And he saw things happen with people groups in India, caste groups that wanted to become Christian. And missionaries divided, sometimes accepting the whole group and sometimes saying, no, this just can't be for real, and they're not really Christian, they've got too much of the old Hinduism mixed in with it, and turn them away. And he reacted strongly against that decision. And his whole idea of people groups, receptivity, God's moment, his kairos in the life of a people, and homogeneous. You have to see against the backdrop of a highly heterogeneous India with people groups who are homogeneous units and want to stay intact. That is the background of McGavern. And now, of course, he sees the world perhaps more perceptively than most of us, as a vast mosaic of homogeneous units, most of which want to stay intact. Also, when they cross into another religion, they want to stay intact. Well, I urge you to pray that we be faced with a problem. What a Christ-honoring thing it would be if that sheikh would bow before Jesus Christ. And that would be something if that would happen. But it would force all of us to do some very hard thinking. And I think the Presbyterian Journal would have some very interesting articles. All right, let's go to number 5. That has to do with mission policies. Now, I remember at the beginning I said that McGavern shook up mission executives very often because he called on them to do some re-examining of mission policies. And related to his emphasis upon ripeness and receptivity comes the proposition that mission policies should be determined by factors of receptivity. You don't pour money and personnel into fields and areas and work that have proven to be unfruitful, but you move where the Lord is moving and where the Spirit is breaking up the soil and producing receptivity. That's the place to pour in your people. That's part of it. And I suppose that they would certainly justify that policy on the basis of receptivity. And they would be given that interpretation very much in the McGavern church growth tradition. You go where the movement, you go with the flow.
Right.
You go with the flow.
Move with the movers.
Yeah. Move with the movers, yeah. All right. What about a person who comes to you now and says, I feel the Lord is calling me to foreign missions. Praise the Lord. I feel called to Libya. Or I want to go into Muslim missions.
Angola.
Now, you can go to parts of this world where after you've learned the language and the culture, you can expect a really abundant number of baptisms and converts and churches. You can see fruits. And you can go to other places in this world where you're going to have very, very little. Now, looking at this now, we're conscientiously making the best use of God's resources, time, lives, energy, money, should you go. And I guess MTW people are answering it in the way you might expect given these principles. Think about it. Number six, periodic evaluations. Church growth methodology is hard-nosed, like a businessman that wants his CPA to give a good account at the end of each year of how the business has gone, who wants to be able to call up his business and accounts department and say, where are we right now? Show me on the graph where my business is, where are we heading? I've got some decisions to make. I want the facts. And you know, and you look at missions history, and a lot of mission work, a lot of it, has been very reluctant to give hard data, real backed up information. Missionaries can be very good at talking very globally, very broadly about all the wonderful things, but very vague as to exactly, like a statistician reports, what has happened. Now, McGavran is dynamite on that kind of thing. He wants growth graphs, he wants data, he wants figures, how many baptisms last year, how many churches started, all of that. And he wants then policies developed on the basis of repeated evaluations and reevaluations. And that, of course, has caused an explosion of all kinds of research in missions. Suddenly, missionaries have to be researchers, statisticians, demographic specialists, all that sort of thing. And of course, that's important also when you are following the principle of going with the responsive, because responsiveness levels can change. And you've got to know when the changes are occurring. And you've got to readjust policy then on the basis of what is happening. So what the church growth missiology has done is it's created a climate in missions in which research, statistical reporting, and a constant reevaluation of strategy and policy and the use of resources have become a very ongoing process. Missions has become much more scientific since the McGavran emphases have come about. Number seven, structures, church and mission structures should be formed and reformed. That's not theologically reformed here, but reformed, reformulated, in favor of structures that are the most productive in terms of numerical growth. Now, I'm going to blow you apart on this one. Most of us here, maybe all of us, are Presbyterian and Reformed in our church polity. But what if we found that in a certain culture, democratic Presbyterianism didn't seem to work? But what makes a church grow in that culture is a good, solid, benevolent dictator. Did you hear what I said? A dictator. I mean a little pope. And people liked it. They wanted the pastor that really moved the troops. None of this plurality of eldership and all that sort of thing. And that's what makes churches grow. You come in with these Reformed and Presbyterian principles, doesn't work. And I can tick off cultures that this is exactly the situation.
Isn't that what England did back in the 17th century?
Yeah. It didn't work anymore, so they changed it. Now, let me suggest that what happens in missions very often is this, that we missionaries have come with our Presbyterianism, and we have imposed it, and we have said this is the way it has to be. And then the national Christians, in their beautiful, subtle way, have taken the structures, but have restructured them. In Mexico, we always said that we, our churches there were Iglesias Presbyterianas Episcopales, Episcopal Presbyterian churches, with bishops firmly in place. You know what I mean? The culture is dictatorial. You don't have a democracy in many of those countries. Democracy doesn't work in that culture at this point in time. Dictators work. And so the political structure is again reflected in the church. And no matter what the church order may say, the culture will reshape itself to conform with what the society really wants. Now, I say this not because I like it necessarily. I'm saying it because it's true as far as reality is concerned. This is what happens. And I'll tell you this, this is one of the toughest things for new missionaries to adjust to, is the way the church operates. In my missionary career, my first years were spent most of the time pulling out my hair. Maybe that's why I got that little bald spot. Because the Reformed Church of Sri Lanka just wasn't what I thought a Reformed Church was supposed to be, particularly in the way it was run. I mean, we had dictators. I'll tell you, we had dictators. In fact, these guys were so bad that they would blatantly rewrite the minutes to conform with the way they wanted it. And that's the way it was going to be. It wasn't what was decided. It was what the president and the scriba decided had to be decided. And a lot of our meetings were just charades because these guys would change the minutes anyway. And pity the poor young missionary that dared stand up to that, because they'd been doing it for hundreds of years. Literally, the church there was over 300 years old. You see, the culture had reshaped. Now, that is, you know, you go in and you realize that it's sin, and a lot of factors affect not only individuals, but the cultures they produce. That's true in government, it's true within the church. Now, maybe this is kind of divergent from what McGavran is saying here, but I guess his counsel to us would be to accept, maybe to a greater degree than most of us are quite ready to accept, the prevailing way structures are formed. Maybe he would say, don't worry about Presbyterian niceties at this moment, but go with the flow, establish the church, and let God iron some things out in the course of time. I think that would be his counsel. Now some hands are going up. Okay.
Well, I would need some real guidance with that, because it seems to me like a Presbyterian form of government, forget the word Presbyterian, but a plurality of eldership would be what the scriptures would want in a form of government. But then I think about Staten Island, New York, where I come from, and the church that has grown there, conversion growth, Roman Catholics, they have now 1,000 people in the church, was an interdenominational church, which basically just ran on a Baptist model with one man at the head. They didn't even have, they have deacons, but those...
No power, really.
There's really this one guy, and he is the Pope. Yeah. But man, I'll tell you, that church is alive and growing, and I think, boy, that's wonderful. I mean, that, I get excited when I go up there to, even for worship, but at the same time I think, Now, should I go from seminary into something independent like that? Because it seems like that's what the right thing is on one hand, but on the other hand, it seems like biblically the right thing is to...
That's where it gets very sticky. And what you're seeing there in New York would have perhaps even more drastic applications in more radically different cultures. But I can well imagine exactly what you're describing there. These people, these conversions, most of them coming out of what? Roman Catholic background?
Italian Catholic.
Italian Catholic. The only kind of religious structure they know is exactly that, a strong priest and a people who follow him. And the priest in a situation like that has tremendous power. After all, he can send your soul to hell, so he's got power over you. And this plurality of eldership is totally out of their experience in the Catholic background. So here's the homogeneous unit principle coming through. Not only are there... They have homogeneity in they're white, they're former Italians, they have a Roman Catholic background, but they also have a certain homogeneity as to their expectations about leadership. Now you could take that overseas into, for example, an African tribal situation, or a Central American dictatorship situation. And you really wrestle with that. You really wrestle with that. I worked quite a bit in Central America at one point in my life, and I helped establish churches there and helped get them organized on a denominational basis. And I saw the dictatorial patterns that seemed to be absolutely unavoidable. The society in general is dictatorial. It's in the pyramid structure with one man at the top, and the church, no matter how hard you try, very soon falls into the very same thing, and the people seem to like it. That's the way they fall in line. That's the way the troops march. And they'll return to it, no matter what you try to impose on it. I'm not trying to be cynical. I'm just trying to say this is the way it works. But there's also a strong pastor-centered hierarchy in Korean churches. Am I right?
Sure.
Yeah. Is the pastor a little bit like President Park?
Yeah. Huh? Hope not.
Thanks for having me on the political side.
Okay. That's exactly what you see in Latin America.
Reflects the political climate.
Okay. Now, this raises a lot of questions. Now, here you are. You're going out to Hokokawana, whatever that is. And now what do? Do you take your structure from here and say, well, I don't know what's over there, but this is it. This is my biblical norm, and this is my confessional statement, and I'm going to establish it? Or do you study how structures operate, how people relate, how leadership is organized, and how leadership is maintained? And then you go again to your biblical data and say, now, where and how do I begin? Not giving up the ultimate, but saying, we're not there yet. At this stage, where they're at, what's the best kind of structure and leadership to put in place to make this church grow?
Reporting back, so like I got all the problems, and I got this different culture. You know, they're all Italian Catholic. They're all, or say, different neighborhoods. They're all Spanish. They're all Puerto Rican. Okay, if I was going to Puerto Rico, I could say, look, this culture functions this way. And I need to make some changes in the Book of Church Order.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
But now in the United States.
Oh yeah.
There's one Book of Church Order for the whole.
Oh yeah.
North America.
Oh, I tell you, that's why the hardest missions is home missions, because you've got Mother Church right around the corner, and everyone's watching. And it's very hard to see. This is again where the church growth eyes begin to come in, is that you see that New York isn't just all one people, but you see that the Italian community and the church that's emerging in that Italian community is going to be different than the church among the Irish or the Scotch or the Germans. See, you're developing these eyes. But then you go to Presbytery, you go to the Synod, and you try to explain that, and somebody from another part of the country says, what kind of a business? What has happened? Where did you study anyway? And then you... And there's your problem. Now, that is why the foreign missionary has always had more flexibility than the work back home. Because you've been able to do things that you could, I don't want to say launder out in your reports, but people expected it to be different because it's way over there. But over here, you've got every Tom, Dick, and Harry to reckon with. And that's tougher. You're right on target, and that is exactly what McGovern's talking about. And he has seen the church over and over again, all self-hogtied over the structural questions, while the growth goes elsewhere. Let's run through the last of these, and because our time is running out, and I want to get on to something else next week. Number 8. The younger churches must be helped to become sending churches. Church multiplying missionary churches. Our job in missions is not done until the churches established have become sending churches. Now that's a beautiful thing that's happening in Korea today. And we trust it will be happening increasingly everywhere. But it isn't happening in some places. There are certain things that you can look for to determine the health of a church. I mean church, broadly speaking now, say the church in a country like Honduras. Number one is, does it produce its own leadership? You know, one of the signs of the weakness of Catholicism in Latin America is that after 400 years, it still does not produce enough clergy for itself. Most priests in countries like Brazil, Argentina, are foreigners. Brazil is the largest Catholic country in the world. Two-thirds of its clergymen are foreigners, mostly Europeans. Now, that right away tells you something's wrong. Because when an organization can't produce its own leadership, always has to borrow from outside, it says something devastating about the condition of that organization. Now, a priest in a country like Mexico, one priest over 8,000-10,000 people is very common. You know that there are, now, Protestants, Pentecostals, Protestants, altogether, are not more than 10% in Latin America of the total population. But there are more Protestant pastors than there are Catholic priests in all of Latin America. Most of them have very small congregations. A lot of them don't have any education. They're self-made leaders. But there are more pastors than priests, even though the pastors are pastoring only 10% of the total population. But there's vitality there. There's leadership is being produced, and it isn't in the major group. Now, that's one earmark of a vital or a non-vital organization. Another is, does it become missionary? Does it not only provide its leadership, but does it multiply? Does it become a multiplying organization? Is it virile? Is it virile or sterile? Okay. Now, that is another emphasis that the Church Growth School is very strong on. Number 9. By the way, you'd be surprised, on deaf ears. The same year that I taught in Korea, I went to Mexico and gave a series of lectures for a week at the Juan Calvino Seminary among the Presbyterians in Mexico. And it was very different. Among the Koreans, I was teaching at this missionary training institute, and I found the churches were really getting excited about sending missionaries. I went to Mexico, and I spoke in the churches and talked in the seminary, and it fell on deaf ears. Now, they were producing their own leadership, but they hadn't moved to the stage yet of thinking in terms of going out. And we must not stop until the same excitement and vision for world evangelization that has sent us to all parts of the world. It's passed on to the churches that we start. Basic principle. Number 9. All the social sciences, the managerial skills, and communication, the science of communication, let's say, the science of communication, all of these should be utilized in obeying the Great Commission. Now, you may remember that I said that this is one of the principles that has gotten McGavern in trouble. Maybe some of you would find resistance in your own denominations, where a kind of pietism or a type of Puritanism forbids the real serious utilization of anything other than pure theology for the growth of the church. Well, you think through that. McGavern would say, we need to study anthropology and sociology and communication skills and managerial skills, very strong on managerial principles, in the carrying out of the Great Commission. Number 10, this will be the last one. There is, throughout the Church Growth Missiology School, a strong sense of urgency. Urgency. The missionary elan which possesses the church growth movement roots in the urgency which it feels about carrying out the Great Commission. And I myself, this was probably one of the first things that attracted me to the church growth movement. I was so disturbed by the lack of urgency that I saw in so much of the church. And suddenly I heard McGavern, and I started reading his literature, and I discovered here something that reverberated in my own heart. Here was a man that really was excited about the Great Commission, and he was saying, let's get on with the job, let's use every scientific tool we can, let's be a bit pragmatic if we have to, but let's get on with the job. And I said, amen, this is the man I've been looking for. Well, whenever you begin to develop church growth eyes, and I hear it developing fast with you fellows, it raises your blood pressure. It begins to increase your sense of impatience with a heady intellectualism on the one hand. I can be kind of critical. You hear me once in a while. You get to be very critical of semantic arguments over words that in the final analysis don't make a bit of difference for anybody's salvation. You begin to at least seem to other people to be pragmatic, when it really isn't pragmatism in the worst sense, but urgency. We're saying, look, there's a heaven and there's a hell, and there are souls slipping into the one that haven't heard about the other. And God has called us to be men in the gap. And you just can't waste your life quibbling about non-essentials. Now, to some would say we've become hopelessly something. But I think that's a biblical urgency. And whenever we lose it, whenever the church loses it, whenever a denomination loses it, you're going to be in trouble. You're going to be in trouble. So I don't think we minimize intellect. We're not minimizing theology in that more scientific sense at all. But we're saying, in and through it all, the Great Commission must be carried out. The world has to be evangelized. And I want to see every man, woman, and child before he dies to have at least one chance to hear about Christ.